Good evening, good morning, wherever you may be around the world. Thank you for tuning in to the best in overnight talk radio. This is Coast to Coast AM, and I'm your host this evening, Dave Schrader. This evening, it's a night where we take a look at the big man himself, Bigfoot, Yeti, Sasquatch. Is there any reality to these stories? A little later on in the evening, the second half of tonight's show, we're going to be speaking with our guest, Andrew Colvin. He'll be talking about the re-release of a book from 1983, Gray Barker's Bigfoot Shootout, Terrifying Tales of Interspecies Conflict. It's a smorgasbord of high strangeness. You guys have to be here to listen to this. We'll hear about the different stories, and we'll hear about Andrew's own thoughts on this. In the first part of the show this evening, Bigfoot, Yeti, and the Last Neanderthal, A Geneticist's Search for Modern Ape Man. We'll be joined by Brian Sykes. He's a professor of human genetics at the University of Oxford and a fellow of Wolfson College. He's been involved in a number of high-profile cases dealing with ancient DNA, including those of Otzi the Iceman, a well-preserved natural mummy of a man who lived around 3300 BC, and Cheddar Man, the remains of a man found in Cheddar Gorge from approximately 7150 BC. Now, it is Britain's oldest complete human skeleton, and Professor Sykes is best known outside the community of geneticists for his best-selling books on the investigation of human history and prehistory through studies of mitochondrial DNA. We'll have him weigh in on the idea and the science behind Bigfoot. Is there a possibility that this beast does exist and science can back it up? We'll talk about that and so much more. Plus, we'll have time for you to call in and speak with our guests, share your thoughts, questions, and concerns. And we'll do that right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast AM. I'm Dave Schrader, and joining me in the first half of this evening's show, Brian Sykes, professor of human genetics at the University of Oxford. And we're going to discuss his search for evidence of the existence of Bigfoot, Yeti, the abominable snowman, whatever you want to call him, including his visits to sites of alleged sightings of these strange creatures. Also been a part of many meetings with cryptozoologists and stories of famous monster hunting expeditions and possible Yeti DNA through his highly regarded lab in Oxford. Thank you very much for joining us this evening, Brian. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure, David.
You've got such an amazing pedigree. I mean, you're well known and renowned for the work that you do. I've got to ask, as a scientist, why would you risk your reputation, you know, working on something this out there in the mainstream science, you know, the look of the mainstream science?
I thought you might ask me that. Well, I mean, what drives scientists is curiosity. And like everyone else, I'm sure everybody listening to your show, I was curious about whether there's anything to the stories of Bigfoot, Yetis, and so forth. And I have been ever since I was young, really, like everyone else. But I did manage to think of a way in which I could throw some light on it, hopefully, by developing a technique with my colleagues to analyze hair samples. So it really became a feasible scientific project, nothing really out of the ordinary, except, of course, the field, a rather eccentric field that I was investigating. But from the point of view of a scientific project, it passed all the marks that I would expect for a project when I'm looking to see what to do. There's material, there's a technique that unquestionably would identify the species of any hair sample or any other organic sample. And I then set out to see whether there were enough samples to make a decent study, which there were. So I got very excited about it and carried on.
I'm curious with your work in this field and working with DNA and understanding where humans come in the whole cosmic scheme of things here, does it seem feasible to you? Well, obviously it must because you're willing to look into it, but I mean, does it seem feasible that somewhere sandwiched in there, there's still this hidden species walking among us?
Well, it's become clear in the last few years that we weren't, for long periods of time, weren't the only human species on the planet. There were Neanderthals, there were a species called Denisovans and some others probably. We were not unique and the only ones that lived here. And so at some point, those other species, most people believe, became extinct. But on the other hand, a possible explanation is that they weren't all extinct in remote places, such as where Bigfoot and Yetis are reported from, might still contain, there might be a few individuals or bands of these creatures remaining in unseen on the whole, and worth looking into. I mean, I must say that when I started, I wasn't really expecting great results immediately with every sample, but such was the importance, if you like, of finding if there were any Neanderthals and other species still alive, that I thought it was worth the risk.
When you're putting this idea together and you're thinking, okay, I'm going to stretch outside of this, I've got an active interest, wouldn't it be great to find another species that does exist? And again, holding yourself in regards to, you know, the work that you've been doing and that you're so well known for, how did colleagues respond to this? Did you get a lot of laughing, or were they whispering under their breath and going, Brian, I hope you find it, man. Let us know what's going on.
Yeah, very good question. A mixed reaction, I suppose. Some people thought it was crazy. Other people, including some senior scientists whose opinion I value greatly, thought, much as I did, that it was a perfectly feasible scientific project and worth looking at, I say, just because, if you like, the prize was so great, and there was a small possibility that a lot of the stories that you hear about were actually based on fact.
Have you looked? I know Dr. Melba Ketchum has taken a lot of heat and flack in the Bigfoot community, and especially with the skeptics because of some of the genetic testing that was supposedly done on some pieces that she had. Are you familiar with this case? Were you involved at all in getting a chance to look at any of these samples, and what do you think of that case in particular?
Well, I talk quite a lot about this in my book, Bigfoot, Yes, in the Last Neanderthal. I was in touch with Dr. Ketchum, but I've never actually met her. Early on, I knew of her work. Certainly when I was in America, that was a couple of years ago, researching this project, her name was on everybody's lips. And generally speaking, people were very mystified by what they heard. Now, as a scientist, I feel I'm entitled to say that the work that she did, in my opinion, wasn't science at all, mainly because she didn't publish her work in peer-reviewed journals, unlike what I have done with this Bigfoot hair research, and it was just published on the internet, and there's no scientific proof as such. It was merely reports, and there was nobody to check it up. I found the paper that she wrote and put on the internet to be a very bad paper. If I was criticizing it as a scientific reviewer, then sort of pretended to do in the book, there are many, many points that I thought fell down. And what surprised me was, one of the things that surprised me, and I suppose rather shocked me, was that although her work was roundly, criticized by Bigfootologists and cryptozoologists in the sense that she never published it, it was very difficult for people to distinguish the difference between bad science, which is what I believe, in my opinion, she did, and good science, which is obeys certain rules, and principle of which is that you should have your work scrutinized by peers and published in a journal that has undergone this peer review process, none of which, as far as I know to date, or certainly when I was writing my book, had been done.
you know, a lot of people want some kind of research done on this. They want DNA testing, genetic look at these samples. And most of them will quote that it's just much too expensive to do that kind of science. Can you shed a little light on me and for our listeners? I'm sure they'd be intrigued to know, what is the truth behind that? Is it to do some kind of workup to get a basic idea that, okay, you know, this is not bear, dog, wolf, chicken, whatever? I mean, is it a very expensive process, or is it relatively easy to do at this point?
Well, of course, that rather depends on what you think of as expensive. It's quite a long-winded process, and I'll tell you why. The main problem with all this kind of work, whether it's bits and pieces of old fossils, as you mentioned, I've worked on in the past, or anything else that is in the environment, the big problem is getting rid of contamination of the sample. That's why so many cases that have been studied before, anecdotally, really, there's never been a systematic survey that's been published. There's a real problem. If you get looking for tiny traces of DNA on organic samples, you're most likely to, you will pick up, without doubt, your own DNA, other human DNA, bits and pieces from the environment. So this technique, which I developed with my colleagues, Terry Milton, principally, involved hair, only hair, and that, the reason for that was hair is an extremely tough material which you can use very rigorous chemical treatment on the outside of the hair to remove any external contamination, which is what we did, and then there's enough mitochondrial DNA inside the hair, if you're careful, to extract and to sequence and thereby identify without any doubts, really, what was in where that hair had come from, what species it had come from. So that's an expensive process. It costs depending on the samples, anywhere between $1,500 and $2,000. And although I have said I'll test other people's hair samples, as soon as I mention the cost, I don't see they lose interest in having these samples tested. For this project, which I eventually got results from 30 samples, I paid for this myself, and also with some money that I got making a TV documentary. So it was expensive, but I didn't know anybody that was in the project. I gave samples, of course. Nobody was asked to pay anything. But that's roughly the cost, and it's expensive because it's involved.
Right. And well, that's what I was curious about. Like I said, is there a real concern about the cost, or is that just something that the Bigfooters are using as a way to not have their stuff tested? But you're saying $1,500 to $2,000 to take a look at it. So there is a considerable cost associated with doing this type of testing.
It isn't trivial. No, it's not trivial.
Right.
It's a real cost. And I always say that the three unanswered questions about Bigfoot. The first is, does it exist? The second one is, what is it? And the third one is, who's paying? And all three of those are not always answered.
Let me hear a little bit about it, if you don't mind, the mindset of going into this. When you're getting all of these samples pieced together, are you able to look at some of them before you even run them and know this is, you know, this is primate, this is canine, this is bear, or do you just try to go into it all blind and just say, let's test this and see what we've got?
Well, because of the cost, I did choose from the samples that I was offered. And let me say now that I had tremendous cooperation from cryptozoologists, not only in America, but around the world, Russia, the Himalayas, tremendous cooperation. So everyone that sent samples was clearly curious as to what their samples were, and that's all to the good. The samples that I got were many and various, including all the most famous examples that I could find from people that were willing to give them to me, and from museums. I combed museums and personal collections from all over the place to get this material.
when you're doing the testing, is it going to strictly be hair and hair follicles, things like that, that you're testing, or are you finding nails, scat, flesh, anything else besides hair?
Well, I decided right at the start to concentrate on hair because with Terry Melton and my technique, we could get a result of species identification unequivocal on only 2 centimeters of hair shaft, so we didn't even need the follicle. Years ago when I worked on hair, you did need the follicle, but so the techniques were advanced, used in forensically particularly, to be able to identify the species of a hair from a hair shaft. So all the other things, I certainly offered those, and most of those I turned down or declined because of the problem of contamination, which I mentioned before. It's, I've been working with ancient DNA so long now that I sometimes forget that most people don't realize how much DNA there is hanging in the atmosphere, and that every sample you have to assume before you start that it is contaminated on the surface.
All right. The reason I ask is I know, you know, and maybe again, I'm just getting Hollywood versions of this, but they seem to be able to grab DNA samples from people, from drinking from a water glass, even leaving their DNA on a cigarette butt. You've got all of these footprints that are found. And now there's this kind of strange phenomena where they're claiming they find these handprints and palm prints. Is there any chance of lifting DNA from that, or do you believe, again, because of the contaminants and how many people are touching the car and doing this, that you would get, you know, way too much to be able to define and break down that there's any kind of, cryptid DNA still viable?
Yeah. Well, I should think there is a chance of doing that. I just chose to do it with hair for the reasons that I've said, that I'd be absolutely sure to be able to decontaminate. But the difficulty is with, say, well, I was offered, for example, food bowls that had been left out and with bait in and had been handled by Bigfoot, but I declined those as well because a food bowl would have been contaminated, let's say, by the owner's prints and so on and so forth. It just becomes scientifically much, much more difficult unless you can really clean it up. So although you're quite right, in forensic cases you can lift DNA up from fingerprints and that sort of thing, very impressively, I didn't think it was the right thing to do here.
All right, fair enough. And knowing what you're specializing in and going at, you can only focus on one thing and try to be the best at doing that. So, you know, that again, that makes a lot of sense to me for this type of research.
Yeah, I guess when you're thinking about doing a project, and I always think quite carefully before I start something, you've got to try and draw the boundaries somewhere, and that's where I decided to draw them, because you must at least give yourself a chance that what you find you really is there, that you really believe that what you find, whatever it is there. It's very important in this particular project because I've got samples from all sorts of places and I was told all sorts of stories, but it really didn't matter whether I didn't even have to form an opinion about whether I thought people were misled or deluded or telling the truth or hoaxing, because I knew that once I got a hair sample and I put it through the lab, I would get the answer.
We're coming up against a break, but real quickly, there's been all of these claims that there have been all of these hair pieces and strands tested through the years, and all but about 4 or 5 have been dismissed. And those 4 or 5 are still counted among, you know, totally undefinable or that they don't know. Do you know, is there any truth to those claims?
Well, I never managed to find a convincing claim from a piece of work that's been done properly. So that's all I can say. I think it's fair to say that the study that my colleagues and I did and published in a journal is the first one to do this properly with a large enough series. But of course, everyone else is very welcome to try, so long as the methods are watertight, and that's going to be the problem, because anybody can test something and they do it sloppily, they'll get the wrong answer, and then of course they might misidentify. Well, they're almost bound to misidentify what they have.
All right, we need to take a break. When we come back, I'd like to hear about some of the locations that you visited, some of the claims that you'd heard through cryptozoologists and hunters out there. What made sense to you? What did not? And what did you find was some of the most glaring problems with the field of Bigfoot research? We'll do that with our guest Brian Sykes when we return to Coast AM. Welcome back to the show. Thank you for joining me this evening. We take a look at Bigfoot encounters, and the science of Bigfoot as we're talking with geneticist Brian Sykes as we try to determine, is there a science protocol for this? If so, how are we doing it? And what are the cryptozoologists, the Bigfoot expeditionists, and more finding out there? Is there anything credible to the claims that we may have a large undefined species still walking amongst us? We'll open up phones a little bit later on in the show. If you have questions or your own stories you'd like to share with our guests, you can certainly be a part of the show that way. But remember, if you have not stopped by and checked out our site lately, go to coasttocoastam.com. Some of the highlights we have in the news right now, the lost Nazi collection of occult books has been rediscovered. And we have a video up right now, 5 undersized and unsettling entities caught on film. And then for those of you that are interested in the animal world and the strange things around us, an enormous anaconda has been captured in the Amazon. There's news and more information about that on the website, plus so much more. Go check out coasttocoastam.com and become an insider. For 15 cents a day, it'll give you a 1-year subscription to the best in overnight talk radio. You get to hear all of the fantastic topics and guests that we speak to every night here on the show. You also get access to live chats, to news, and special features. Go check it out. Become a Coast Insider right now. We'll be back. We've got more with our guest, Brian Sykes, right after this. Bigfoot, Yeti, and the Last Neanderthal, a geneticist's search for modern ape man. According to the press release and the book, you were able to go out and actually visit some of the sites of more of these well-known encounters. And going out there for yourself, kind of immersing yourself in these situations and seeing what they're up against for collecting really good evidence, is it extremely hard because of how much contamination from people and other animals there are in those areas?
Well, as I've said in earlier part of the program, contamination is always an issue, but I had the most wonderful time. I like to immerse myself in whatever I'm researching, and I certainly went to some wonderful places, many in America, and met some fascinating people that I wouldn't ordinarily have come across. So it was a great time.
And when you meet with these investigators, researchers, and experiencers, how good or how flawed are they in the way that they're out doing this research?
Well, the stories are certainly convincing. I'm rather gullible person, really, but it didn't matter whether I believed or not because I was testing the DNA, and that doesn't have any opinions. There were, again, as you expect with any group of people, there were people of different extremes. There were people who clearly were deluded. They thought they saw things that they didn't see them. They had very poor evidence. What often happened, I found, was that some people had seen something. Very often, to them, it was clear they'd seen a large creature in good light, and forever after, it was almost like a religious conversion. Forever after, they were searching to prove or to see it again, or to prove their case, because I can imagine that they would have told their friends, and they said, oh, come on, you're making it up, or you're wrong, or something like that. And that's a spur, quite often, to people that redouble their efforts to go back and prove that they were right all along. And I think there's a lot of that. So what I call the Bigfootology enthusiasts had, on the whole, started their interest in that by some sort of personal experience. Lots of other people I met had had the similar experiences, but they hadn't gone on to develop a passion for cryptozoology. Once I think people have been convinced themselves that these creatures exist, then they become less objective and not sufficiently objective. This is not all of them, but some of them, and will not look at the evidence in a dispassionate way, which, of course, a scientist has to do. I had to do that. I didn't find it difficult because I did have some very strange experiences, but none that I couldn't explain in other ways. So, on the whole, although the cryptozoologists say they're doing research, it's not really research in the way I would define it in a scientific way. So what people tend to do is, if they've been to a place and they see something, they'll go back and back and back and just repeat what they were doing before without, on the whole, and this is the exception to this, varying their procedures now, for example, that there is a way of a scientifically accepted way now of testing hairs, for example, concentrating on getting a hair sample from one of these creatures as opposed to, say, a photograph or something like that, which, however good they are, they are not definitive proof, especially these days with all the image manipulation you can do. So they're very enthusiastic, they're very committed, they put in a lot of time and trouble. They're delightful people on the whole, but they're aren't really doing research in the way a scientist would do it if they had good amounts of funding. But, you know, they'll find something, I'm sure.
I'm curious, with all the work you've done in ancient man all the way through, if you have hair from human heads from 2,000, 5,000, 7,000 years ago, and you've got human hair from human heads right now, and you match them up, will it automatically show you that there's a difference in the type of human that they came from, or does it just show you that it is, in fact, human hair?
No.
The reason I ask that, maybe if I explain this, it'll make more sense.
I understand the question. I think the hair doesn't survive for very long. I mean, all the ancient DNA works done on bones and teeth. But if you could, it just depends on which particular piece of DNA you're looking at. And you can identify a modern human and compared to a Neanderthal. It's easy to tell the difference between those two. And you can compare modern humans with an ancient human, and you can see that they have identical or extremely similar sequences. There's a great range of techniques you can use which concentrate on particular pieces of DNA to make the most of what you're looking for.
My thoughts on that, and the reason I asked that question, you know, the Native Americans believe that they are nothing more than just another large, hairy human tribe that still exists, and they're just very adept at keeping hidden.
Yeah.
And we know that there are species, native species, or human species in places like the Amazon and even Australia that are very adept at remaining hidden in plain view. Yeah. If we got some of this hair from a Bigfoot or Sasquatch and it is mostly human, could that be what's throwing off some of these tests? Or are you finding that the majority of every animal or every hair sample you get is just a known animal species that has nothing to do with humans or bipedal humans?
They weren't all known animal species. Some were, but you'll have to read the book to find out the detail. If, for example, you found that one of these Bigfoot, let's say, was actually a regular human, it would be hard. In fact, I did find human hair amongst the samples I was given. Well, what does that mean? Does it mean that this was maybe somebody hiding out in the forest or something like that, or someone didn't want to be found? You're dead right. They're very difficult to to find the and very secretive animals, whatever they are. They don't seem to have to want to have anything to do with us. So then you just have the answer, well, they're human, but whether they're actually Bigfoot is the question. How would you know that the sample you found, for example, a log cabin after an attack, like one I found, was a human? A human hair left on a windowsill, as I recall, but after what appeared from the people inside the log cabin had been a Sasquatch trying to get in. So it was, the hair was human, so, but was it a Sasquatch or was it just a regular human, maybe not doing what a regular human normally does? You see the dilemma.
Right, and that's why I was wondering if this is, you know, problematic for this, because if Sasquatch is nothing more than just a version of us that's a lot better at hiding and a lot better at keeping close, you know, yeah, close away, well, maybe we'll never find that answer. Maybe they're so easy to hide.
Yeah, you'd be able to tell the difference between, for example, a completely modern human, as this hair on the log cabin was. It was identical in every way to a large number of modern humans. You'd be able to tell that from, for example, a different species of human, such as we're now finding. So that would be quite easy to tell the difference between those two. But if it was just a woodsman or something like that, then it would show up as a modern human.
And one of our listeners, Anne, had written in, and she said, Dr. Melba Ketchum, and we talked about this a little bit earlier in the show, has repeatedly tried to have her research published in good peer-reviewed journals, but the moment these journals discovered the subject was Bigfoot, they would not go anywhere near it. And they're saying that it's akin to asking NASA to publish papers about UFO and
well,
UFOs and aliens.
Let me say straight away, that's complete nonsense, because just because you submit a paper for publication doesn't mean to say it's going to be published. If it's not up to standard, it won't be published in a good journal. And it can't be true, because the Bigfoot study on the hair samples was published, my study was published 18 months ago or so, in a reputable scientific journal. So that claim is just nonsense.
All right. Now, you've done so much work, and again, that one was one that we brought up earlier, the problem you had was that it wasn't published in a proper peer journal. There was nothing about it that you felt was very good science. Talk to me a little bit about some of the work and how the Bigfoot community is reacting to the findings and the research that you are doing.
Well, I'm not actively involved in this project anymore, so it's only what my friends and the friends I've made in the Bigfoot community tell me. Certainly, I think they're taking note of it. I mean, it wasn't my intention to show that everything was, well, not everything, but a lot of samples were not what they had been thought of as. But that did happen occasionally. So samples that had been donated in good faith as dead cert Sasquatch may be turned out to be bears, for example, or wolves. And in that case, I think people naturally might feel disappointed. I suppose sometimes I felt, well, should I really be doing this if all I can do is prove that samples are dear to people's hearts and who they've taken a lot of trouble to find, prove that they were something else. But then on the other hand, unless you have a stringent test, such as the one that my colleagues and I developed, you're not really getting anywhere. You have to have a test that will show something is a bear or a horse or something like that. And if I had been given, or any sample I was given, I was absolutely sure to be able to identify it as some sort of unknown hominid, because the test was so good and so rigorous. So I think people, perhaps not surprisingly, are sometimes a bit disappointed if their particular sample isn't what they thought it was, But on the other hand, I came across a large number of cryptozoologists with the right attitude, in my view, was that now, at last, for the very first time, there was a test that could be done on material they found in the forest and that everybody would accept. That's to say, the hair technique. And so they were going back and trying to get the, what became known to me and my friends as the golden hair, the one, and you only need one that will prove beyond doubt that the Bigfoot was an anomalous hominid.
You had a couple of unexpected results that you talk about in the book. And I know you want people to buy the book to read and hear about some of these stories, but can you give us a little insight on either the Yeti mummy that was part of it or the ape woman that you include in the book?
Yes. I mean, I can certainly tell you about the bear, the Yeti mummy, which turned out to be a bear, which isn't so surprising. This was a mummy that was found by a French explorer called Christoph Hagenmüller about 30 years ago when he was traveling in the Himalayas. He read about my project and volunteered this sample. He had brought some hair back with him all that time ago, and I tested it, and it was certainly bear, but it was a very unusual bear. It had its closest genetic match to a polar bear, which you don't expect to find in the Himalayas. There's still work going on that, and an expedition is planned, and I hope we'll go ahead to find some more of these bears, because I've got two samples, in fact, one from the Hagenmüller sample from Ladakh in India on the western Himalayas, but also a sample from Bhutan, matching exactly from the eastern Himalayas. So my contention would be that they're still alive and living, these strange bears. Now, whether they're a different species or hybrids or something like that, or a result of hybridization, which does happen in bears, between bears and brown bears and polar bears, that remains to be seen. But the indication is certainly worth following that up. The other one was a very strange case that I'm still investigating, and it's still very strange, which was the case of in the mid-19th century, what you might call an ape woman, or certainly a very strange creature, was captured in the Caucasus Mountains, and I go on to say how and what happened to her. I was able to extract DNA from her son's skeleton, which had been exhumed. Extraordinary story. A huge amount of work by Russian colleagues to get this material, and I was able to look at that closely, and the results are in the book. And also track down, with the help of a documentary team, living descendants of this ape woman, if we call her for want of a better name. Her name was Zana. She was captured, she had children, and I tracked down with my friends from the documentary six descendants. And I'm now studying, almost finished really, studying their DNA, or the DNA that they've inherited from Zahn herself, and putting together a better identification of what she really was.
Intriguing nonetheless, right? I mean, there's still some amazing things science has to find out. And even if it means that you've got to go back in time to unearth these projects and unearth this evidence, are you still astounded that here in 2016 there are still mysteries that are unfolding that we're finding? Or do you think there's even more coming that we had no clue existed?
Oh, there are. I mean, especially in the realm of other humans. I mean, some extraordinary results coming out now from DNA studies on ancient specimens. We can now, or if some people can anyway, get results from humans that are nearly half a million years old and get DNA results from them. So tremendously exacting and tremendous achievement of laboratories that do that sort of thing. And they're sharing that there were other species around, as I've said, what they were, and the amount of hybridization that's gone on between those other species and our own ancestors. So this is all brand new and is rewriting human evolution as we speak.
We are going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue with Brian Sykes. We'll take your phone calls. Does our guest believe that Bigfoot does exist? We'll ask him about that and more when we return. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM.